This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Recy Palmer's music career has always reached back to history. As one of the few black women ever to place on Billboard's country music charts, she occupies a space where few black musical foremothers have stood. With four albums to her credit, Recy felt she had enough perspective to launch a new radio show. Color Me Country Radio is produced for Apple Music Country and features Recy talking with other black country artists, as well as Latinx, indigenous innovators who are also part of that genre. She's with us today to tell us more about her latest endeavor, as well as the unique triumphs and challenges of being a black female country artist, and how she's managed to maintain longevity in an industry that is still predominantly white and male. Recy Palmer, welcome back to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Good to have you. We had you here about a year ago. You were talking about what was then your latest album, Revival. And at that time, you and your family just moved to Durham from Raleigh. So how are you liking it?
Oh, well, actually, no, I think what it was I just had a baby. Because we've been in Durham, November will be 4 years.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. I think it was the baby.
It was the baby. Well, you would know. You would know better than I would. That's something you just don't forget.
No.
So how's that? And not your first. So but now how are you adjusting to all of that?
It's like now we're juggling.
Yeah.
Like it's one ball of fire before with one child, and now I'm juggling two balls of fire while doing everything else. But no, it's awesome. She's a year old, and she's just now walking, and she's like a mini, very cute, curly-headed tornado.
Meanwhile, the other big news since then is the pandemic. How are you weathering that? I mean, in terms of creativity and family, I mean, you're always juggling so much. We're going to talk more about that. But then now this, how is that affecting you?
It's been interesting. It hasn't changed the way we operate in the house too much because both my husband and I work from home. So he's in his office, I'm down in mine, and the only difference is having my 9-year-old home all the time doing school upstairs. It's been a lot of togetherness, a lot of family movie nights, a lot of, okay, mommy needs to go down to her office and close the door and don't knock. Honestly, I have to say, like, we're very blessed. And, some people lost their jobs and have lost homes and that kind of thing. And we've been really very fortunate. So I hate that we're going through this, and I hate that this is happening. And, you know, I've lost 3 people in my life from COVID. Mm. So it's an interesting mix. It's weird to say that, you know, we're okay while the rest of the world is burning down.
Yeah.
But my personal family, like the 4 of us, we're okay.
Yeah, and in the midst of all that, you've actually added your new radio venture, the Apple Music Country new program, Color Me Country Radio. Been keeping you pretty busy, I would guess.
Very. It's funny, when I first started recording the interviews, it was just my show. Like, it was just something that I was going to do by myself. And it was a podcast. And it's something that I had thought about, but I didn't have time. And now all of a sudden, all I had was time. So, and I knew that everybody was going to be home because nobody's on the road. So I was like, well, if I'm going to do it, I might as well do it now. And I started recording these interviews, some of them, like, we got the call that school was canceled, like, March 15th. Mm-hmm. I started doing them, like, March 20th.
Wow.
And I've been working ever since on this.
Well, I'm going to talk to you more about that because it's a fascinating project centering on black, Latinx, indigenous innovators in country music. But let's get to your story and the roots of your personal history with music and performance. You knew fairly early that you wanted to sing. What was one of the earliest memories you have of seeing a live performance or when you got bitten by the bug?
Well, according to my baby book, my mom said that I constantly sing all the time, like even when I was like 2. So even before I knew what I was singing or what the words were or any of that, I always just love music. And I think the earliest memory that I have of, like, performing were at church. We belong to a church called First Baptist Church of Swickley in Pennsylvania, where I was born. And I can remember standing on a milk crate so I could reach the microphone because I was so short and singing Jesus Loves Me for the Easter program. And, like, I remember vividly practicing for it. My mom would rehearse me every day and have me just sing it and sing it and sing it until it was right. And so when I got up there, I was so confident, and I knew I was going to do it. I was going to blow them out of the water. And she even choreographed. I remember she choreographed, like, oh, I know that it was, it wasn't Jesus Loves Me. It was, He Lives. He lives, He lives, Christ Jesus lives today. And at the very end, it's like, you ask me how I know He lives. He lives within my heart. And I took my hand and put my hands over my heart and scrunched up my shoulders because my mom told me to do it. And everybody, she was like, people going to love this. And as soon as I did it, everybody's like, oh. So, I just had that memory just now, just talking to you about it. That is so funny.
That is lovely. That is so lovely. And I can see you scrunching the shoulders and then looking heavenward as you grasp your chest. Oh, beautiful.
It'd be so extra and like, and just extra in five. And so.
But you talk about wanting to blow, knowing you were going to blow them away. Now, how old were you? How old were you at this time?
Five. I was
5 years old. Now, there's a lot of five-year-olds who standing in front of the church on that big day with everybody all dressed up would be thinking about anything but blowing them away. I'd be like, how do I get out of this mess? So you were not only were you not terrified, but you really had the expectation that this was going to please the crowd.
Oh, yes. I was like, I'm going to kill them. I don't know. I just had that thing. Like I've always been, for better or for worse, I've always been a people pleaser. And I've always been someone who wanted to elicit a response from you. And so my mother was like, my biological mom, who passed away when I was 7, was always the life of the party, was always the funniest, was just always this beautiful, like, a friend of mine used to call her, like, Black Barbie. Like, she was just this beautiful, brown-skinned, impeccably dressed, educated, big Sunday hats and gloves. Like, she was all about the pageantry and all of that. And so I was just like, I want to be that. If I'm going to be anything, I want to be like my mama. And so my mom knew how to do that. Like, she knew how to speak and how to turn a phrase and make people laugh, make people feel things. And I don't know, I guess I just kind of tapped into that very early. And I was just like, that's, whatever she has, it's it, and I want that. And so I was like, if you're standing in front of people, clearly what you want is to make them applaud, you want to make them laugh, you want to make them feel things. And, like, I don't know. It sounds crazy, but like that, it was very, that's what I wanted.
Well, no, I can understand that. And that is something you drew from your mom. And the other part of that was their musical taste, a broad musical taste, right? You listened to a lot of music, yeah?
No, my parents have, I always tease them. I was just like, y'all don't have to leave me anything but your record collection. my parents have an amazing record collection, and when my father married my stepmom, she brought her record collection, which made it even better. And yeah, so we listened to Aretha Franklin, Peter Frampton, Dolly Parton, Patsy Cline, and so it was always, to me, country never felt like, when I was a kid at least, it never felt like it was weird. Like, it always felt like it just fit into everything else that we were listening to. So, like, Saturday mornings were the main time we listened to records, and that was because we were cleaning the house. And, you know, one moment we'd be listening to Andre Crouch, and then the next minute it would be Kenny Rogers or something like that. And so, yeah, it just always kind of, it was just always there and always in the back of my mind and always kind of in my spirit. And that's why I think the music that I make now, like, I don't consider myself to be a straight ahead country artist by any stretch, like, because there are people that do that and that are amazing at it. And so I don't want to, take away from what they do by calling what because it's a mixture of other things. Like, my music is a mixture of R&B, it's a mixture of country, it's a mixture of pop, and there's some gospel influences in there. And, like, that's why I call myself a Southern soul artist, because it's, like, it's got, like, a lot of these Southern sensibilities as far as, you know, country and soul music and all those things that make that originally made combined to make country music, but it's not what I would consider to be traditional country.
But you that all of that said, and those influences certainly are a big part of your work and what makes your work stand out, but you also had a deep sense of what it meant to be a country artist, did you not? I mean, you met your first managers when you were 17, and
Yes. That's
when the whole shaping your image began to be an issue, right?
Yeah, 100%. Like, we, I'll never forget. It's funny, I just told this story, but I remember I met them when I was 17 and I was still in high school, and they were two black women, and their primary experience was in rap and hip hop and that sort of thing. And I graduated high school in 1999. And so most of the music at that time was like Shania Twain and, like, as far as country is concerned, it was Shania Twain and Faith Hill and the Dixie Chicks and that kind of thing. And everything else was like super pop. It was like Backstreet Boys and Mariah Carey and Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera. And so if you're a teenage girl, you're a 17-year-old girl, and you're looking at all these different people and who you want to be, I naturally wanted to be the people that look like me. So I wanted to be like Lauryn Hill. I wanted to be sexy like Mariah Carey. You know what I mean? I wanted to be that. And so I remember us going.
I'm going to break right here. I want to hear the story.
Sorry.
I'm going to hear the end of it. We're going to hear what happened when you covered a Patsy Cline song, Leaving on Your Mind. And I'm talking to artist Riesty Palmer today on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. More of that story when we return. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking to Durham-based country music artist Riesty Palmer today. Riesty got her start in music as a kid, singing and performing with a children's group in her Pittsburgh community, Team 11. At the end of high school, she was ready to broaden her scope as a singer and entertainer. She was about to confront some big challenges, and that came along with being a black artist in the country music industry. And Riesty, we were talking about meeting your first agents at the age of 17 and you being at a crossroads, deciding, you know, sort of who you wanted to be now that you were going to have to actually create an image. So tell us more about that.
Yes, and I'm going to try to be more succinct. I talk a lot. Anyway, I just remember us working on my demo, and the original demo that we were working on was pop. And one night when we were in the hotel, they're like, well, what do you write? Like, do you write songs? And I said, yeah, actually, I do. Well, play something that you just wrote. And so I was like, well, this song I wrote for Reba McEntire. And they looked at each other like, what? And so I sang the song, and they're like, that's a country song. And I said, yeah. And they said, and you sang it like a country song. And I was like, yeah. They're like, Riesty, that's your thing. And it just never dawned on me, because I'll be frank with you, I'll be frank with you, Frank.
God, let me be frank.
It was, that's so corny. that it was, there was nobody that looked like me. Yeah. And so I just didn't think that that was something that I could do. I was just, I said, well, black people don't really do that, right? And they're like, but you do that. And so they encouraged it. And honestly, they're the reason why I felt confident enough to pursue it.
And you did, but here's now where it starts to get complicated, because now, by the time you're 19, so a couple of years later, very famous R&B production duo offer you a contract. Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, who are best known perhaps for their work with Janet Jackson.
Yes.
So that's a big deal, and that's quite an offer, but tell us how that worked out.
Well, they knew when they met me, the demo that I gave Terry Lewis was my country demo that I had done with artist Deborah Allen. And he loved it, and that's what prompted him to call us. And so we had a meeting, and everything was great, and I sang country music in my audition for them and everything. And once they offered us a deal, one of the things that they said was they felt like it would be better for us if we pursued a more pop direction. It could be acoustic, but it had to be more pop. And that partnered with some other things, like they didn't want to work with my managers at the time. They wanted, I had a production deal. They didn't want to do a production deal. They wanted to do just a straight ahead record deal. And so all those things together, I didn't want to be disloyal. And I also didn't want to change musically what I was doing. And so it was a really hard decision, but we opted not to take the deal.
It's so fascinating to think about that. I mean, finally somebody says, sing where your heart is, so you do. And they say, yeah, that's great. Now let's change it.
Let's change it. And like, you know what? I'm not mad at them. And,
right.
And I think honestly they were just trying to be like, that's we don't have any connections over there.
Right.
That's not what we do. But this is what we do. Like, pop is what we do. And so if we like you and we think you're talented and we want to keep you in the area that we know for sure that we can excel in.
Well, you did sign
with
1720 Entertainment, and then you released your debut album in 2007. We'll talk about that fit and how that relationship worked out.
It was nice at first. No, 1720 was an independent label based out of Atlanta, and the owner, we had some of everything. Like, there was a soca band, there was a rap artist, like several rap artists, there was a pop singer. Like, so they had a bunch of different things, and so it wasn't like a country label, so to speak. So they had to basically build a record label around me. Like, we came to Nashville, I already lived in Nashville, and they hired radio promotion people from Nashville. We got marketing people from Nashville. We got a PR person from Nashville and built like a Nashville arm just solely to push my career. And like I said, at first it was great. And it was a lot of, you know, because we're a fledgling label, like there was a lot of hand-wringing about a lot of things. Like, one of the big things that we fought about a lot was my hair. I've worn my hair natural since I was 18 years old. And any black woman will tell you that to get to the point of complete acceptance and love with your hair sometimes is a journey. And that was the case with me. And I had gotten to a point where I love my hair. This is what God gave me. This is what it is. And everybody was like, well, you know, I don't know, it's kind of an afro, and I'm not sure if country audiences will be into that, so maybe we need to straighten her hair, or we just get her a wig, and then she can just put this wig on, and we'll take pictures, and she can do the wigs and that kind of thing. Now, if you want to wear a wig, that's totally fine. That's on you. Like, that's choice, but that's not what I wanted, and I didn't want to cover up my hair to make myself more palatable for anybody.
Right.
So, you know, there were tons of things like that.
Well, also some discussion over a love interest for one of your music videos, right?
Oh, yes. For the video for No Air, there was much controversy. And mind you, this is black and white people because the staff at 1720 was extremely diverse. I will say that. And we were trying to figure out where we wanted a love interest and that sort of thing. There was a football player in particular that I wanted in the video. I was single at the time, so I was using this as a dating opportunity for me. And he was black.
Uh-huh.
And the label was just, like, a lot of people at the label were just like, well, you know, are people on CMT going to want to see two black people rolling around in the sand? And then it was like, okay, but if we get her a white co-star, are people going to want to see an interracial couple? And so, we debated for like weeks about this. And I was just like, can y'all just call this football player, please? but all this back and forth.
Yeah.
But no, what it ended up being is me by myself. And so if you look at the video, it's just me wandering around this island by myself because nobody could figure out who I should be in love with.
Who is well, but see, this is fascinating to me because I know you don't want to demonize anybody. You're being very careful, and I think honestly so, or earnestly so. They're looking at the business side of this. They're saying, well, look, we love your talent. We want you to sing where your heart is because that's beautiful and we love it. On the other hand, we do have this other audience out there that doesn't look like you and doesn't expect what it is that you're going to show, whether it's your hair or your love interest. Kind of fascinating in a way. It's sort of, how do we manage to what extent do we take a leadership role and risk, like, not selling your record, right? Or do we just go where the algorithms have led us, you know?
I think I'll be honest with you. Like, I was pissed a lot of times, and I was angry, and, like, I had black management pretty much the entire time. And I can remember my manager and I'd like, this is so dumb. Like, this is so stupid. And you're trying to balance not being like a problem artist, but at the same time trying to be yourself. And it was always like, I'm a black woman. Like, you can't extract, that's a part of who I am. It's who I am. I'm proud of it. And I've been that all my life. And so I didn't want to hide any of that. I didn't want to pretend like it wasn't something. Like, I didn't want to be, oh, she happens to be black. Like, no, I'm black. And, you know, like, I insisted that we have black publications that we spoke to. Like, if we're going to talk to Country Weekly, we're also going to talk to Jet. We're going to talk to Ebony and Essence as well. And, like, and Vibe. And I'm pretty sure I'm the only country artist that's ever been in Vibe. And so it was really important to me that we show all facets of who I am. And it was disappointing to have these arguments and have to have these conversations. And, you know, I tried to be a team player. I have some horrible pictures at home of me in a stupid wig trying to make everybody happy. It was a lot.
Well, let's listen to some of the success you were having with the label. This is your hit from 2007, Country Girl.
That makes you walk the walk. And come Sunday morning, palms up and praise. It's all about my mama name and eyes raised. It's a state of mind, no matter where you're from. Living like your grandma does. It's good home training and a common thing. If this is who you are, let me hear you say, oh, you don't have to be a Georgia peach from Savannah Beach to stay, from Arkansas to appreciate a Southern girl. Don't need no key from West Virginia to have it in ya. Show the world you're a country girl. Says it with a smile. Oh yeah, as sweet as molasses down home style. I'm what you might call real corny. Oh yeah, I'm a country girl, born and bred. It's a state of mind, no matter where you're from. Living like your grandma did. Let me hear you all clap your hands.
Now come on now.
Ladies, if you understand, let me hear you all clap your hands.
Yeah, clap your hands.
If you hear me and you know you're bad, all your country girls clap your hands.
You don't have to be a Georgia peach from Savannah Beach.
No, you don't.
From Arkansas to appreciate it, a Southern girl.
Southern girl.
Don't need no king from West Virginia to have it in you.
No.
Sing it away, the Southern girl.
Sing it.
country girl.
That was the 2007 hit Country Girl, and I'm talking with artist Reese Palmer today. Reese, we're talking before that song a little bit about your struggles with the industry itself, but also the mistake that you think the industry is making in not believing that Black audiences care about country music.
100%. I think that it's a friend of mine, a producer and executive in Nashville, he's a Black man, and he says all the time, you're leaving money on the table if you don't explore this other side. And I think everybody is so busy trying to make sure that you're palatable for, frankly, for white people, that they completely miss that there's like this whole other thing of you just being yourself and attracting not only white audiences, but attracting audiences like you. And that was, again, one of the reasons why I pushed so hard to make sure that we were included, that Black publications were included in press and everything else. Because I think that if I like country music, I know that there are other people like me that like this. And it would help to see. Like, if I had seen a me back when I was 17 years old, then we wouldn't have had to record, like, we wouldn't have had to go through all the paces, because I could have said definitively, that's what I want to do, because I know that I can do that.
It seems the fear might be, well, we might alienate white audiences, but it seems to me that, I mean, if that's the case, it's like, well, we don't want to go in that. We understand there's some money to be made over here, but if we go there, do we lose this? And I just wonder if that's true. It's like, well, if they don't want that, they won't buy your record. They'll buy the other records, right? I mean, what do you lose?
And I would rather people, right, and I would rather people not buy the record because they don't like it, rather than, like,
yeah,
they don't like me, rather than give them this other facsimile of myself,
right,
that's palatable for everyone, and they still don't like it.
That said, again, these questions of images, niches, where are you going to position the artist, you know, despite or because of their talent, plays a big role in your career all the way through, because that label, 1720 Entertainment, eventually acquired by Universal Records, which led you to actually leave your mainstream level label and strike out on your own. Talk about that experience in that transition.
Oh, Lord. Well, no era was the straw that broke the camel's back. They wanted me to record a crossover song, and I did not want to. I thought that was dumb, because I felt like we had spent all this time trying to establish me as this authentic and sincere country artist, which I spent the entire time I was in Nashville and in quote-unquote mainstream country music trying to prove. And now we're going to do a pop song. I was like, this is dumb. And I didn't want to do it. And I told my manager I didn't want to do it. And he was just like, I know you don't want to do it, but just try it. So I did. And it just caused a lot of infighting. And it became clear that I wasn't really valued or appreciated. And just a lot of bad business decisions on the front end on my part and on their part led to us parting ways.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that. I want to interrupt you here, and forgive me, but I want to hear a little bit of that song and then come back and talk more about it. So the song is No Air, and let's take a little listen to it. Cover the pop song that was first released by Chris Brown and Jordan Sparks, No Air. That's Reese Palmer's version of that. And it did well, right?
It did. did. It actually, ironically, because it's the song that I didn't want to do, it's the highest charting thing I ever did. Like,
right?
Because that's how the universe works.
Right, but so. that is the koan that is this industry, right? It's like, no, it's not me. No, yeah. I don't want to do it. And everybody around you saying, you know, I think this is going to work. You know, and it does, but you didn't, and you walked away from it, and then ended up doing, you know, going independent and making your own records after that, right?
Yeah. I left. That came out in 2008.
Yeah.
I filed my legal paperwork against 1720 in 2009, and I got out in 2010.
Well, we're going to find out more about where you went after you got out with Reese Palmer today. Just ahead, how Reese's new Apple Music show, Color Me Country Radio, helps black and brown listeners connect with country artists that look like them. Meanwhile, as we take a break, let's listen to Somerville from Reese's The Back Porch Sessions EP.
Running barefooted through the summertime. White sheet drying on that old clothesline. You said, child, wash your feet before you come inside to eat. I'd show up at the start of June. August always came too soon. As we'd pull away in our Ford door, you'd stand crying on your front porch. You were when love was still in Somerville. Shed a tear, I cracked a smile when I let my mind wander down the country mile. When love is real in Somerville. You take a ham bone and flat green beans, turn a bear cupboard into a feast. If you didn't have nothing, you couldn't tell me. You always had my cherry ice cream. You raised us all on kisses and honey. Jesus and switches, stretching money. You knew God and you gave him to us. We had you, so we knew love.
Country by my heart is still in Somerville.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking to country music artist Reese Palmer about her life and work, including a brand new radio show that she's hosting for Apple Music Country called Color Me Country Radio, in which she interviews fellow country artists about color, their careers, their country music, and the reception of Black, Latinx, and Indigenous voices through the industry's long history. We'll talk about that in just a second, but before the break, we listened to Somerville, which is from one of your 2015 EP, independent EP projects, mm-hmm. The Back Porch Sessions. Talk a bit about that song, but also the album itself and its inspiration.
So the whole project was named The Back Porch Sessions because I started singing on my great-grandmother's porch. And that was the first place that people gave me money, the first place that I realized that people liked to hear me sing, and even though they were relatives and all that, but still. So it was the first project that I had done independently, and I decided that, if this is the first, then let's go back to the place where all this started. And yeah, so that's what's behind the name.
Well, you know, it's interesting to think about that, because here you are, I mean, you had some success with the label, but now there are these creative differences and you have to part ways, and you do, but now you're on your own. So where do you go from here? And your instinct is to look back, you know, where did I come from? Mm-hmm. It seems to me that's what you said. Did you, and it worked pretty well. I mean, it's a wonderful set of music, and it was fairly successful for an independent project. But talk more about what you may have learned from that by going back over the roots and then bringing that forward to where you are today.
Oh, 100%. I think the biggest thing was I needed to remember why I loved music, because I hated music. After, going, if you've ever been to court for anything, if you've ever been sued, you know that it makes you hate whatever it is that you were suing and being sued by. And I was burnt out. I was tired of answering questions about my authenticity. I was tired of Confederate flags. I was tired of arguing about my hair. I was tired of all of that. And so I got married in 2010. I had my daughter in 2011, and I was cool with just living in North Carolina and having my baby and, making crock pot chicken. Like, I was good. And then when I decided that I was going to make music again, I did a children's album first in 2013 just to kind of dip my toe in. And then I was like, okay, I think I'm healed enough that I can do this. Because it was bad. I cannot stress enough how bad the scene was in 2009 and 2010. And I had anxiety. Like, I had developed stage fright and all of that just from that time. And so I had to look back. I had to try to think of all the reasons why I loved music and why I wanted to do this in the first place. And so, yeah, it was like a revival of sorts. Like, to be perfectly honest with you, it was like rebirth.
Yeah, but it's interesting. Well, go ahead. Finish that thought.
No, it was. I had to just be reminded of all the reasons and all the things that I loved, and I went back to producers that were friends and that I loved and felt safe with. Like, everything had to be really safe because I was like very tender at that time.
It's interesting, though. I mean, you could have gone another way entirely, which is to feel that way and say, I'm never going back there again. I mean, there's a lot of, just from what you've described, a lot of pain. Why go back there? But you made the decision that you wanted to, and therefore needed to find a way back. That's not obvious. That's not obvious that one would do that.
I mean, like, I'll be honest, I'm not really great at a lot of things. And so music is the thing that moves me. It's what I love. And, like, I was taking baby music with my daughter, and like, I'm in the car listening to the music from her class, and like singing my heart out to these like Froggy and Froggy Went a Courtin'. And I'm just singing it, and I'm just like, you want to sing. Like, yeah. I know you do. You want to sing. I'm saying this to myself. And so it's just like, you'd be doing yourself a disservice if you don't sing again.
And the more time you spend in a studio, the less time you have to spend making crockpot chicken, which for me would be the one reason. I would actually start a career in music to avoid that. But we won't talk about crockpot cuisine. Actually, most of it's good. The chicken. Let's talk about this new radio show of yours, Apple Music Country. Let's talk about the title first of all. Inspired by Linda Martell. Tell us who Linda was.
Yes, Linda is the patron saint of the show. I say that all the time. She is the first Black woman to ever perform on the Grand Ole Opry. Her record, Color Me Country, which is why I named the show that, came out in 1970. This is the 50th year of that album. She started in 1968. She was supposed to be the female counterpart to Charlie Pride. And she was on a record label called Plantation Records. And yeah, I mean, she only made the one record. And according to her last interview with Rolling Stone, like, she went through hell, which is what I'd always assumed and what I heard and all that. But I just felt like she's the reason, she's the foundation that all of our houses are built on. And I say all of our, I mean us women of color. She was one of the first to put herself out there and to endure racism. I mean, think about what the world was like in 1968. And she did that. And she was on Hee Haw, and she was on all these shows. And, like, up until recently, nobody really talked about her. And so she changed her name, and she lives in South Carolina now, and she's driven a school bus and raised children and all of that, and just very clearly carried a lot of pain from that time. And so I felt like I wanted to honor her because she's like my foremother, and I feel like she should be just as iconic as the other women that were around at the same time as her.
We'll talk more about then the what's behind the show and what you're trying to accomplish with this show.
So the whole idea of the show is to provide a platform for artists of color who are in the genres of country, Americana, and folk, and to just give them an opportunity to not be othered. Meaning, a lot of times when I was doing interviews, most of the journalists that I was speaking to were white, and for all intents and purposes, made you feel like that was the most important part of your story. Not that I had written most of the 12 songs on my debut album, which wasn't normal. Like, that doesn't always happen for everybody. And then, you know, that I play the guitar, that I do all these other things, like all these other things that I find to be interesting about me were apparently not as interesting as me being Black. And so I wanted to create a space where these artists could talk about their artistry, could talk about their experiences and not worry about having to be political or being, I have to measure the way that I speak to Reese because I don't want any retaliation or people to be mad at me. Like, you can just be real. Like, we're peers and we're both Black, or we're both people of color. So, girl, I know what happened, or I know how that feels because I felt it too. And just give them a space and play their music. Something so simple, like just play their music. And then also play the music that I love and that they love and the music that influenced us, and that doesn't necessarily mean top 40 or like the five songs that like a lot of radio stations like to play over and over again. Like, we have a wide variety. The show last week had Willie Nelson and Erykah Badu on it. Like, we try to keep it as open and as loose and as whatever, like, whatever you're influenced by, that's what I want to play.
Well, and also I think a misconception is that this series wasn't going to go very far if it was going to be about women of color in country music, but you quickly disabuse people of that idea. There's plenty to talk about and plenty of people to talk with, right?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. No, I remember telling people about it, and they're like, oh, is this just going to do this for, like, a couple episodes? And, you know, and I personally, just in the triangle, I know of like four women. And so I was just like, if I just talk to people that I'm friends with and I talk to artists that I just know of on Instagram, if I do a quick Google search, I'm good. And like, I have already done 26 interviews and I still have an inbox full of people that I'm reaching out to or that are reaching out to me to talk to. And I've just talked to women. I haven't even gotten into men. So, like, this is, it's anybody that says that black people or people of color are not a part of country music is insane. Because I can tell you, I can attest that we are here and we are out here and we need to be talked to. And I'm a firm believer in using my platform and not only that, building my own table. If you don't want to call us to come sit with you, then that's fine. I'll call everybody to come sit with me.
Tell us what we're missing. Tell us what we're missing. Talk about some of the people who we should know about and understand their position, their place in this. People that you're going to be talking to and about on the series.
Well, I talked to, like, the very first real episode, not the introduction, but was Meiko Marks. I think Meiko Marks is amazing. And she was before me. Her album came out before my debut album came out. And she kills me. And I think she's doing the best music of her career right now. And so she was the first person that I thought of when I thought of doing this project. I found a couple who, at this point, are the only husband and wife black duo that have played the Opry's and had music on the charts. And they were back in the 60s. They were 1967, Sarge and Shirley West. And I found their son, and so I interviewed him, and he's doing a show, and there's so many. Like, I found that in the 70s, because of the success of Charlie Bride, so many record labels ran out and got black and indigenous and Latino artists, and so I'm going to do a show just centered on the 70s, where we talk about, like, Barbara Cooper and Virginia Kirby and Ruby Falls. And I just found a woman, Nisha Jackson, that won back before CMT, there was TNN. And she won the first reality show that they did, talent show. She beat 800 people. She's a black woman from Texas. She ended up getting signed to Capitol Records. They put one song out on her, and then they shelved her. And she had uprooted her whole family and came to Nashville and ended up having to go back to Texas. So there's so many stories like this of people who, like, proved that they were worthy and make great music, and for whatever reason, hint, hint, wink, wink, never made it.
Well, let's talk more about the reason, because we mentioned it before. There really doesn't seem to be a good business reason for it, and that's what I tend to want to blame all of these things on, is like, well, everybody's afraid of the effect on the bottom line. But, let's take a look at, like, Lil Nas X crossover hit, right? Old Town Road getting stricken from the Billboard hits because it's not country enough. Black art, it was making money. This is the thing I don't understand. So when you nudge, nudge, wink, wink, is it just, can racism actually trump, I will use the word advisedly, good business? Good business.
Yes, yes. Listen, not everything is about race. I'll say that. But this is, I firmly believe that. I think that, like, with Lil Nas X, for example, there have been so many countless examples of rap music and country music meeting together. Tim McGraw and Nelly. There's Florida Georgia Line and Nelly, and pretty much anybody the Florida Georgia Line works with. Cowboy Troy. Nashville has always dabbled. Sam Hunt put out mixtapes. Like, Nashville has always, the industry has always dabbled and stuck its toe over in hip-hop. But the moment that a young black man, independent artist, is able to circumvent the system and put the music out himself, now we got to stop him. Like, that's the line. And look, it doesn't matter if you like it or if you're a fan of it. It's like, the fact is like, what's the difference between this and I Play Chicken with the Train? There is no difference. And so it's like, so it has to be, at some point, it's just like, okay, if it's not the music and there's nothing that's different about this music, then really, what is the problem?
Do you think in this moment there's a time for a real change, a real sort of upending of that system?
Absolutely. And I think that it's bigger than just who you sign to your label. It's who's working in your label. If you look across the board, I said this on Twitter, and it's so true. If you look at your board in your boardroom when you're having a meeting and everybody looks like you, you are doing this wrong. And it's music, for God's sake. Like, it's not, it's music. And so it's like, how can you exclude people of color? Like, everybody makes music. And not only that, country music is not just a white art form. It's one of the most thoroughly American art forms, and that is because all the cultures have had a hand in some way, shape, form, or fashion of making it what it is. And so to exclude them is to completely to darken your history, like to cut off part of your roots. Like, it's ridiculous.
Or to bleach it, depending on which way you're trying.
Right. Or to bleach it. Like, it makes it such a richer story if you include parts of it. And that's why I'm doing this.
Well, what about some of the surprises for you? You obviously had some intentions going in, but have you been surprised? And what are the discoveries that have really, surprised you the most?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a sad realization, but so many of the stories are exactly the same. Like, there are so many through lines in these interviews that I've done that it's ridiculous. As far as, like, experience and being rejected or being told why you're not going to work. And the excuses that you get are very similar. A positive thing is that I find that the church is a real big part of a lot of these women's story. Whether they completely stay in the church or not is, you know, it varies on the artist. But a lot of the women, their love of music, their learning of music and performing all starts in the church. And I thought that was really interesting. And I found artists that I've never heard of before. Like, in just doing research, I found Sergeant Shirley in an ad in an old billboard on the internet that I was looking for another artist. And I was like, wait a minute, who is that? Those are black people.
What are they doing? Well, to hear more of Reese's discoveries on the Apple Music Country Show, Color Me Country Radio, you can listen to that show, and we will link to it at our website, stateofthings.org. Reese Palmer, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much, Frank. It's great.
And you can see her perform online October 3rd at the IBMA Shout and Shine Online Showcase. Again, we've got links to that at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall of Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Jenny Lawson, our technical director, Al Wadarski helping out today, engineering today's show as well. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.